I'm Michaela Talkington.
And I'm Jo McGrath. And we're the founders of Flourish CIC, an organisation that helps women changemakers to flourish. This is our Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast, and it's designed to help you on your journey to make a positive difference. In this episode, we're looking at measuring your social value and communicating your impact. Social impact, why bother? Well, I guess this comes back to why you set up a social enterprise in the first place. People that set up social enterprises as opposed to commercial ventures want to see some good happening and see some positive change in the world. So when you set out on your journey, we have to think about two things. One, what's your customer value proposition? So what will your customers pay for? And also, what's your social value proposition? What difference will you make in the world for your social venture? The only way you'll ever know if you've nailed this is by measuring your impact. It'll support you in selling your idea, and therefore it could attract further funding, customers, and collaborators. Your impact is essentially your story, and it's an important piece of your marketing strategy. So in this episode, you'll hear from Kat Lookock. She's a social impact coach and business mentor, and she's got some really interesting ideas for you to start communicating what you do. Then we welcome back Grace Dyke to the podcast, who shares with you her tools, tips, and tricks to get press attention for your work. In our Flourish Talk section, we talk to our network about the different ways they're keeping a track of the amazing work that they're doing. But first, our producer Vic speaks to Nicola to understand what we mean when we talk about social value. Nicola, thank you for joining me today to talk about measuring social impact.
Mm-hmm. Thrilling topic for everyone.
It is. It's an important topic though, isn't it?
Oh, I'd say so, yeah. Still a long way to go to help people understand why, but for sure it's important.
I think you're going to give people a good idea over the next...
I'll certainly try.
You are the expert though, after all.
One of a handful of good ones, yeah, hopefully.
So we're talking social value and measuring your impact. I think what a great place to start is for you to tell us what is social value.
It's really all about trying to understand what difference you're making. It's as simple as that. You know, if you wanted to define it, there are lots of agencies and organisations out there trying to define it, one of which is the SROI network, Social Return on Investment Network, and they say social value is the relative importance of changes that occur to stakeholders as the result of an activity. It's like, well, what the hell does that mean? So it's no wonder these things baffle people. But ultimately, it's about trying to work out what do people value about what you do and how are their lives changing as a result.
Go on, give us some examples.
Lots of people use training and education as a way to help people improve, people gain skills, people gain confidence, there are things that happen. And when people are looking at, you know, what are the benefits of what they're doing, if it's a course, for example, you know, just turning up to the course is an output. People have turned up, they're there, it's a tick in the box. But so what? I would say, and funders and commissioners, just because you've got them in the room, was anything of value? Did anything really happen? So one outcome might be if Sarah or whoever you want to say has attended this course, they turned up and what happened, they might have improved their confidence. Sarah might have made new contacts. Sarah might have gained a new skill in something. So those are all outcomes of you running this thing. The impact of that, so what happened with that newfound confidence, with those new skills, with those new contacts, what then happened that improved? And so she may have undertaken some volunteering, or she may have used those skills to get a job, or she may have taken that knowledge and skills and run her own session in something. So it's following the journey, it's tracking the journey of what the difference is that you're making. And then that is all impact. Some people are well off the spectrum and don't even look at this stuff. They're just running what they're running, jogging along, hoping it's working, hoping it's going to make them some money and hoping they're going to make a difference. But once you've been running things for a little while, to stand out against the competition, to attract funders and investors and other people, you know, this is the kind of why bother. Tracking and understanding and monitoring who's turning up, what they're doing and how their lives are changing as a result starts to become more and more important.
It's adding colour to those black and white numbers.
Definitely.
And almost, like you're saying, building a story around those numbers and those box tickings. And so why is it important to measure this stuff then?
If you can't demonstrate your impact and then on top of that, understand the value, and the value of that being, as I say, how people's lives have changed as a result, how collectively that might be saving the public purse money, or how that might be changing things en masse for society. The reason it's so important is it's a crowded market out there in many ways. And if you're going to stand out and understand or help people around you understand why to invest in you, why to choose to come to your service and so forth, they need to know it works, is for one. You need to know it works. You're spending all these hours running this thing. Have you any real concept that it's making a difference in people's lives? You know, lots of people can run one-off events or can run a one-off thing, but so what? When you start going for larger funds, larger contracts, trying to speak to commissioners, there's lots of ways that people try and attract income and investment into what they're doing, and especially in the social enterprise world, liaising with the public sector and liaising with the funding sector is a core part of what people do. Without the information, real information, not just figures pulled out of the air, not just some remote research that somebody's done, it builds legitimacy to what you're doing. When you get to that point, you can build an independent legitimacy to what you're doing. And you put it nicely, you know, it helps you tell a story. So whilst a lot of trying to look at what social value measurement is can be the black and white, and it can be number crunching, and it can be looking at stats and data and what they call these social value proxies are. There are some databases and some methods out there that people use to cost up. If you know that the service that you're offering is saving people trips to the GP or it's saving people stays in hospital, there's figures there that you can then calculate, and that's what the value comes in. And this is the bit that people miss. They get to the point where Sarah came on the course. They got to the bit where she's improved her confidence and she's now got some skills and a job, but they then forget to look at what the wider value of that is. And that's where usually once you've got to that point, you need to start bringing in other people to help you, because that's where it starts getting a bit more fiddly.
We've gathered all this colour, and then trying to find the value to that seems quite complicated.
It is. And, you know, measuring the value and putting a calculation on it is one end of the spectrum. Carrying out surveys, getting testimonials, having videos, you know, there's different ends of the spectrum of how you look at this. But certainly once you've gathered your information together, be that through questioning people, having focus groups, doing surveys, reviewing videos that you might have taken, can often have really good, valuable information in around social value, and people don't realise. Once you've got that, you've then got to turn it into something that helps you calculate your worth and the worth of the services that you run.
And what methods can we use to do that calculation?
Yeah, so there's all sorts of methods out there. The ones that people might have heard of, or the ones that I certainly use, they are social return on investment is something people have heard of. That's quite a costly, very lengthy, very detailed. And that's the one where it tells you, you know, for every pound invested in this company, X amount of pounds worth of value is returned. But there's a lot of detailed, in-depth work that has to happen to get to that point. You've got other methods. So there's this thing called LM3, and this is about looking at how the money stays in a locality and how money, they call it the leaky bucket effect, you know, where people earn money and they go and spend it all over the place. They don't necessarily spend it in their local area. And that's where we lose our high streets and lose money locally. And this helps you track and show that you're having a local impact in your local area. And that can be useful for local councils or for a lot of these place-based funds that are out there. And an accessible one as well is around something people might have called outcome stars. This is used a lot more in sort of health and well-being outcomes and what value you're adding to people's lives emotionally, socially, and in terms of health and well-being. And some sectors have developed their own specific metrics and methods for doing this. So the housing sector, for example, have, the environmental sectors have. A lot of this information is out there on the internet to have a look at, but it goes over a lot of people's heads. And I would say there's a point where it's worth bringing people in to help you. You know, obviously there's a cost to that, but with the right consultants, the right people, they should support you to do as much as you can in your own way, and then have them come in and do the bit that really needs doing. I've worked with quite a lot of organisations now, helping them develop their social value reports, and they use that data in reports to help communicate with their board, to help communicate to their customers, to improve their marketing materials, but also to go into funding bids, commissioning proposals, even like award nominations. And I know people I've been working with have been getting through to shortlisting stages and have been securing additional resources. Flourish ourselves, I mean, we've done some social value work in the last few years. We've paid quite a bit of attention to this. We've done so much ourselves, obviously, because we're specialists at this, but we've brought in additional consultants to legitimise it and to sort of complete it and make it more robust. And that's paid dividends for us and helped us secure contracts with councils and get lottery funds, because the quality of the information that we're putting in our bids is so much better than it was a few years ago.
the steps you've had to do before measuring your social value to make sure you've got that great data, what are the sort of steps that Flourish has put into place that you're gathering the right data to measure that social value?
There's different ways, isn't there? People have to be able to track and monitor things, and you can make it as complicated or as simple as you want. And in our case, most people we work with are either small teams, or they haven't got huge budgets for this, so they have to keep it simple. But something people forget to do is to build this in at the start. You have to build this in early. Otherwise, 2-3 years down the line, if you've nothing to benchmark your impact on other than what people say, which go so far, but it, you know, so Flourish is an organisation with lots of people who are, I wouldn't call them members, but they're part of our network. So certainly people who come to our annual mentoring marathon or people who come to our events will find out kind of who they are, a little bit about them and where they're coming from, so that we know the events or the support that we offer has made a difference to them. So it's the case of benchmarking, asking questions, be that around people's backgrounds, be that around people's levels of knowledge and skills or well-being at the time of coming into contact with your organisation, your services, and then tracking that certain points after you've supported them. And more importantly, 2 or 3 years down the line, that's the other bit people forget. You don't know what value your service has had until way after people have benefited from it, and people don't put the budget or the time in, or even the simple surveys or staying in contact with their clients through simple networks or Twitter or whatever, so that they've got methods of finding and keeping hold of people, so that they can ask them the right questions. So I would say for us, getting feedback as part of our events, because we run peer learning events, we're asking questions all the time to gain insights from the benefits of what we're doing. And then in order to do our social value work, we'll then do one-to-one interviews with people, or we'll run focus groups. And it's not rocket science. You're asking them, you know, what do they value about your service? What do they value about what you do? What have they valued most? So you need to peel out the priorities, what, you know, and see what the themes are that are coming back. You need to look at, so what? So what's changed? You know, what's now happening? Is there anything they're doing differently now as a result? What has this led to? And then when they start to give evidence of what these things are, patterns emerge. And once these patterns emerge, it's the patterns that you track. It's quite a strategic process, and it's not hard. It just, if you don't put it in place, it's not there. We now know that, you know, we need to be tracking things like, you know, skills and knowledge and what that leads to, because income generation, both personally and professionally, is important to us. At Flourish, we're trying to increase women's economic independence. We need to know, you know, has that happened? Mm-hmm. Have you increased your turnover in the last year or two? Has that meant that you've earned more income? Have you been able to afford a holiday? So it's tracking the ripple effect. And, yeah, you know, that's done through conversation mainly, and it can be done through surveys and online stuff. If somebody who, you know, was a former refugee who's now in work, setting up their own business and is benefiting other women from vulnerable backgrounds, and their kids are now well fed, have got what they need in life, and kids have got hobbies when they've never had a hobby in their life. You know, it's that sort of ripple effect. You can take it to the nth degree, mm-hmm. unless you ask the questions, you don't know.
So, Nicola, have you got any examples of organisations that are or have measured their social value well?
I can think of a couple of examples that I've worked on that they seem fairly happy with the way we've gone about it, and another example that's more in-depth as well. So there's an organisation based in Manchester called Levantou Market. They're a social enterprise market, and they were set up as a sort of women-led organisation by someone we still work with. They'd been running for 5 years, and they wanted to part showcase and celebrate what had been going on, but really understand what was what. So that was a really thorough piece of work. You know, it didn't cost heaps, actually, in reality. You know, it was about 20 days work, which sounds like a lot, but that's the sort of more thorough end. And we looked at, they have market traders that we had to interview and work with and find out what they benefited from as being part of that market, and how their businesses were growing as a result. We were talking to local residents about how they benefit from the market, what they value most. It was the atmosphere. It was a sense of community spirit. It was a community pride. And then the wider stakeholders. So you've almost got sort of direct people, direct stakeholders that you know, who's got a vested interest in what you do, and then the wider world. And yeah, their strategic partners, their funders, local MPs and other people, the police. estate agents. We were interviewing all sorts of people to gather their feedback on the difference that was being made in Leven's Tomb as a result of that market. And it was quite phenomenal, really, that, you know, I didn't believe it at first. House prices changing as a result, people feeling more of a sense of pride in the local area, criminal and antisocial behaviour, reducing people feeling more safe. And, you know, Leven's Tomb Market, they've put hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of investment in the Leven's Tomb area has happened now as a result of that being there through them changing the landscape and changing the area in terms of the car park they operate out of and, you know, the greenery they put in and all of the equipment that they use to pop up that market every week. But it's had a knock-on effect as well with wider businesses and wider investors wanting to invest there now. So
that's incredible. And they wouldn't have found that information without
if we'd not been so thorough. We all got a few surprises there, and that was good. Just another quick example, I'm working with an organisation called Horse Herd. The ladies there came on our mentorathon the other year, and we quickly recognised they were doing a great job, but they'd not got any communications to demonstrate that. And I think you're speaking with a colleague of ours, Kat Lecoq, within this podcast, who we work closely with because we do the donkey work and pull out all the information and work with other people to kind of beautify and polish and communicate that well. We've worked as a double act together on this horse herd work. They work with veterans and young people who are having challenges at school and challenges in their home lives through, it's called equine facilitated learning, but it's basically working with horses almost in a quite a spiritual and sort of counselling type way. You've got to see it to believe it. And the findings that we're getting there from talking to the children that are, and the veterans that are going through programmes, their parents, carers, teachers, other support agencies, is really demonstrating the difference that's having on people's lives. You know, where veterans now who've got potentially physically disabled and have got all sorts of PTSD and mental health issues and have been isolated for a long time are now returning back to work or improving their lives in various ways, going on dates, moving house, getting back in touch with their estranged families that they'd never got back in touch with for decades. So there's some real stories that you can draw out if you, as I say, if you know the questions and you start to ask them.
I was surprised when I came to the event that we'll hear Kat later on in this podcast was talking at. I was speaking to a few people there and they don't measure anything. They just go do their work and get on with it. They've never felt a need to measure it. Never felt a need to gather any data.
It's really hard to get people to understand why this is important and to want to do it. But ultimately, if you don't do the social value measurement work, you can't get quality income generation happening and you can't get quality comms. So we need to work harder to help switch the message to help people see why this is important and why this is where you start. And you're very right that you start to evaluate and monitor what you're doing, and that then evolves into intelligence gathering and value measurement so that you can start to quantify and qualify what you're doing in a much more professional way, really.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nicola. Coming up, we'll hear from our network of social enterprises about the different ways they're measuring and telling the world about their impact. But first, we hear from Kat Lecoq. She's the founder of an organisation called Share Impact, which works with businesses who want to communicate and measure their impact better. She's got some brilliant ideas about how you can start communicating what you do. This was recorded at a recent Flourish event, and we'll tell you how to get to our events right after we hear from Kat.
Share you a little bit about my story. 7 years ago, me and my friend Jen were given an incredible opportunity to take over an education programme that was running in Leeds Bradford area. It was not for profit and essentially was a charity. They just hadn't got charitable status yet. It'd been running for 8 years successfully with schools across the West Yorkshire region. The board had had a little bit of conflict. They'd run out of money and they didn't have a strategy for what they were going to do. They were about to close the company. Me and Jen, I'm not going to go into the story about how we got there, but we ended up in a room with the CEO and she said, why don't you just take it if you think you can do something with it, which doesn't really happen every day. And we decided, Jen had just done her master's in business and community. She knew about this idea of social entrepreneurship. I knew nothing about it. But I had worked in the third sector for my whole career and I'd done a lot of grant funding. So I knew that if nothing else, we could maybe bring together some of our expertise and get it set up and then see where it went. But I was really interested in this idea of social entrepreneurship because being in the third sector, I knew that funding was disappearing and I knew that we needed a new model for how we were going to support fund social and environmental initiatives in the future. Because I don't believe grant funding is the solution. I don't believe it's healthy and sustainable for organisations to be dependent on grant funding. So 7 years forward, I'm no longer operationally involved in Solutions for the Planet. Look it up. Jen is still very much involved. I'm still a director. But through our journey, so we essentially have a trading model. We still apply for grant funding. We're still successful at grant funding. But it's a very small proportion of our income stream. Not within the first 18 months, but towards the second half of the first year and over that 18-month period, we successfully secured over 100k in income and then have continued to do that since over the last 7 years. Through both grant funding, but the majority of it is through corporate income sales that we sell to corporates, not sponsorship and it's not donations. We're still at the moment not for profit, but our goal is to become profitable, not so that for ourselves as directors, but so we can invest that profit long term into the business growth and expand in the way that we really see we have a vision for the organisation. That's been our mission from day one, that social enterprises should be profitable, that they should be trading, and that we're not a charity, and therefore we're not going to ask for sponsorship and we're not going to ask for donations. We are going out there to sell you our services. It was a real mindset shift, and all the School for Social Entrepreneurs, the Unlimited programs that we went on, we were asked to talk about this because we were the only one in the room saying this is what we wanted to do. We're not massive as an organisation. We've got 5 staff, but we do deliver to 3,500 kids every single year across the UK. We've grown slowly. We're strategic about what we're doing, and we're clear about what our values are and what's at our core. I came away from it 4 years ago, A, because I live in North Wales, and I was on the road 4 nights a week, and it wasn't very practical. I wanted to start a family. I just got married, and I wanted to spend more time at home with my husband rather than living on the road. But I also really wanted to help the social enterprise sector a lot more. Me and Jen were really frustrated that every single training we went to, all the conversations came back to the boundaries of funding. So I'm really, really passionate about changing that conversation. We're not talking about that today, but hopefully some of this will be obvious about how that relates. One of the things we really learnt over the last 7 years is that the corporates, our customers, the language they used for what they wanted to achieve and that their needs was very different to what we were trying to do in schools and how we talked to teachers and head teachers and how we sold it to schools. That's just a fact. So we had to learn their language. We had to have lots of meetings. We had to do a lot of research. We had to spend a lot of time in the corporate space, which I had never done, and it was absolutely terrifying. We were the only young women in those spaces. It was deeply uncomfortable, but we knew they would happily talk to us and share everything about their businesses, and it gave us a huge competitive advantage. And I'm not saying you have to do that, but you do have to put yourself in uncomfortable situations if you want to do the research and learn where you want to take your business and learn the language. So that's sort of my journey. I now run Share Impact, which is just me, but it's helping social entrepreneurs measure and communicate their impact better. And I generally at the moment focus a lot more on the communication side because that seems to be where people are asking me for support and advice. And I do it predominantly online, so I work internationally with social entrepreneurs all over the world. And interestingly, I generally work with social entrepreneurs that are already in the space where they're thinking about creating profit. They've never really applied for grant funding. They've gone straight into generating income. And so it's really interesting for me to hear your experiences and to hopefully support you, because I know many of you will feel very uncomfortable with the idea of becoming a business and selling and moving away from funding to generating a trading income. But it is possible. And even if it's not 100%, there is lots of ways, regardless of what your organisation is, if you're willing to try it, to generate that income. I discovered a passion for helping social entrepreneurs and making sure that the sector as a whole, I do think social entrepreneurship is the future of business, full stop. I want to be in that space. I want to be in that innovative space about changing business. And the other thing, though, I found that I really wanted to do, and what I found I was actually quite good at, was helping people gain confidence in what they do through the coaching methods that I use and thinking through how they can communicate their social impact and social value differently. So what I'm going to show you today is some tools. We can't do the whole communication strategy, but we're going to look at social media. First of all, who can or does communicate their why they exist? So often we do it, we can and do it face to face, or we do it with our team, or we do it in training sessions because we're asked to do it. Anybody that hasn't read the book Why by Simon Sinek needs to, because it's brilliant. I never remember the full title, but it's a really just look why, and there's a really good short TED video on it as well. If you do nothing else, getting really good at just communicating why you exist. Most social entrepreneurs, it's the easiest thing to do because you're passion-led, you're value-led, you're gut-led. you know why you're doing it. It's not very easy to communicate sometimes until you pull it out and practice, because it is that kind of touchy-feely stuff. It's soft. It's stuff we don't used to talking about. If you're British, we don't talk about those kind of things. It's the stuff we think isn't tangible, isn't the thing that other people are interested in. But actually, whether you're selling to a huge multinational company, you're selling to an academic, or you're selling to your local health board, they are individual people that you're selling to. And you're not going to be able to successfully sell to everybody, but when you make a connection on that personal story and you're sharing why you do it and why you do it as a business and an organisation, you will find people that you connect with. And you'll either find people who go, yeah, absolutely get it, I've got money, I'll go and figure out how to give it to you. Or what actually is more powerful in the long term is you get people that go, they remember your story and they tell 10 other people, or they put you in contact with somebody that they know that can give you the funding. And it builds your network. It's a much more powerful way to tell your story than this is who we are and what we do. Read Simon Sinek's book. He explains the science behind why it works. But most social entrepreneurs, and this is a big, put it in big writing on your thing, check your website. The first thing most people, social entrepreneurs, do on their website is describe what and who they are. We're a social enterprise and we do this. It's a killer. Nobody cares that you're a social enterprise, or it doesn't really matter. You don't see Tom's Shoes, who are a social enterprise, put it first. You know, they are a social enterprise, but they don't say we're a social enterprise and we do this. They tell you why they exist, the change they're creating, the problems that they're solving. That's what's going to be hard hitting and get to people's hearts and minds and purses. So whether you're selling to consumers, businesses, or funders or investors, you need to start with your why. Once you're actually comfortable sharing it, it is a much more powerful way to communicate, even in day-to-day interactions. Okay, so the next question is, who are your customers? And by customers, I mean the people that are going to give you money. Who is it that you want to be speaking to? You know who your customers are. They're the people right now that you need to be speaking to, or at least over the next 3 to 6 months. Like, look, over the last month, who are the people externally from your organisation you've been speaking to? Are they customers? Is it 80% of your time speaking to customers? And I know this is really difficult because I've been there. If you're operational in your business and you're not just, well, you're CEO and you're doing everything. I did that for 3 years. I know that's difficult to think. You know, I've got to spend, we spent, you know, 3 days a week in schools delivering sessions. But I knew that as much as possible, that other day a week, I had to be either on the phone, at an event, out speaking to my people that were going to pay me in the future. Because otherwise I didn't have a business. So if you're not doing that, and that also it made us really, really focus about, we don't have enough capacity. For 3 years, we didn't have capacity for the organization we were running. That was a reality. And I know that's a reality for most organizations, but it got us super focused about how much money we needed to bring in. We knew that we needed to, you know, our 150K was our first income goal. Not 20K, it was 150K. Because that just meant we could deliver what we were delivering right now at a healthy capacity. That wasn't to grow, that was to be sustainable at the point of delivery. And I know that's the reality for most social entrepreneurs when they're starting out. But it helped us get super focused. We were working pretty much every day of the week for 3 years. And it's exhausting. It is not healthy and it is not sustainable. But when we got serious about, you know, we needed to get out there and speak to our customers. Okay, so where in the week are we going to create time to do that? Maybe we actually need to cut back our activities, because actually it's more important right now for our sustainability in the next 6 months that we get the money in and deliver to less students. Because otherwise in 6 months we don't exist. Because actually I have a chronic health condition, Jen had a chronic health condition, we cannot sustain this. And you know, you have to get that real, that's what business owners do. Well, how do we make this business sustainable? So I think you have to sort of start to make that shift. Where am I spending my time in my business? Even if you are doing grant funding applications, are you spending 80% doing grant funding applications? If not, why not? So hopefully, a much long-winded way, but we've solved the first problem of thinking through who you're targeting your impact communications to. Many social entrepreneurs, like we've talked about, are communicating something. They've got a website, they've got a Facebook group, they've maybe got a few pitches and proposals, they're writing grant funding applications. They are communicating who they are, what they do, and why they do it. They're sharing their impact in some way, shape, or form. But are you doing it in an intentional way for a particular outcome, goal, or purpose? So I really want you to start thinking about your communications, because actually if you're scurrying around thinking about what am I going to put on Facebook this week, or, oh, there's a funding application I need to put in for tomorrow that I've suddenly just found. that's not a good productive way to run a business. It's not a helpful way for you to succeed. And so being intentional about your communications is one way that you're going to make it much more effective. And even if you do 1 hour a month on your communications, it's going to make a much bigger impact than what you're currently doing, I imagine, if you're not doing it in a strategic or an intentional way. So now you know that you're trying to be intentional, you're identifying who you're communicating with, there's four other things we need to do. So where are those people? What platforms are they on? What channels do I need to use? Or where are they that I need to go to go and speak to them? How do they like to consume information? This is often what we forget. We want to share it in a particular way because it's easy for us to do it. You might be sharing on Facebook. It might be completely useless to share on Facebook for your audience. This is why going to where they are is really important, because you start to learn about how they want information. So when you know what information they like to consume and how they like to consume it, that's really key. And then the final thing is, what do we actually say? So what's the content that we share and communicate with people? But unless you go out there and do it and research and speak to people, you won't be able to do it. Until you do the research, until you learn it, and it, you know, and you, it's different for every business, because every business has got a different customer. So unless you are your customer, i.e. you're the customer avatar that you're selling to, you need to go out and find out. A, you need to decide who your customer avatar is, be willing to allow that that's going to change as you meet more of them and you learn more about them. And then you'll find out through trial and error as well. So some of the things I'm going to share is, you just got to try it and see if it works. If it doesn't work, you can try it again. If it doesn't work, then stop, try something else. The problem is, we often keep doing things that aren't getting us money. Like, why do we do that? Like, we keep going to the same funder asking for money. Move on. They're not going to fund you. It's a waste of time. It's because it feels safe and it's in our comfort zone. So the key to your content is crafting your impact story. So there's four parts to your impact story. So the reason why you exist. So this includes your why, the problem that you're tackling, why you care. And that can be individually or as an organization, depending on whether you're like a personal brand or whether you're a bigger organization. And then this key thing, why should other people care? So you care about this issue, but so what? That's not going to sell it. It's about why should other people care? You've got to be able to persuade and convince and articulate it in a way that's going to get other people interested. So, and the easiest example that everybody uses right now, but is Blue Planet and the plastics issue. It wasn't, and it's crazy that it took David Attenborough to have a TV show to communicate it in a way that made lots of people go, oh, now I care. It doesn't matter that David Attenborough cares. It doesn't matter that climate scientists care all over the world and have all that expertise if we're not all collectively doing something about it. It only matters when we kind of look at, why do other people, or why should other people? They might not care about it now, but why should they care about it? Well, because the planet's going to die. The second thing, what you're doing to create change. So this is the easy bit. This is probably what you're already communicating. It's, you're probably talking about this all the time. You probably talk about it too much. So your vision, what you plan to do, examples that explain the journey. So this is usually, if you work with people, the journey that people go on, the journey that you take your customers on, your beneficiaries on, you know, what's the journey that people are going on with you? Evidence. This is the tricky bit. The data that actually demonstrates what you're doing is having a making a difference. And you probably already have all the stuff in your organization. It's just about pulling it out. And then the bit that we often forget about, but we usually have in our organization already, is the stories, testimonials, and case studies. And if you haven't got the evidence yet, just jump on ahead and use this, because it's just as valuable and it's just as important. And you can come use this to then back up the evidence when you get the evidence. Now, there is a difference between testimonials and case studies. Testimonials, I think, is something that you need to, it's not feedback. So it's not what you get on a feedback form. It's three or four questions you intentionally ask to be able to share a story in a way that's useful for you as a business. It's not asking for feedback. It's asking intentionally the journey that they've gone on, so that you get an individual, for example, sharing a testimonial that you really want to be able to say, this is who we are and what we do. It's kind of framing it, which is why it's not evidence, but it's still from their words, their language, etc. So a case study, I would say, is more your words. And you might include a testimonial in a case study, but it's more your words about, this is what happened, this is why we did it, we spent this much on it, these were the results. It's like a mini impact story. So how do you actually use your impact story to create content? So I'm going to give you a suggested approach. It won't work for all organizations at all, but I would recommend you try it. First of all, I want you to think, and you don't have to do it right now, but think of one social media platform out of either Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn or Twitter that will work best for your target customer in the next 3 to 6 months, not you. So I don't care what platform you're on right now. I don't care what you like to post on. Which platform is your target customer on? So write that down. And over the next month, so the next 4 weeks, I am going to challenge you to create, and I either do this like when you go home tonight, this week, as a bulk activity, or do it every day if that's easier for you. But I'm challenging you to create 20 pieces of content that you're going to share daily, weekdays, daily on that platform. So 4 of those over the month are going to be you going live on video. Why? Because video is what works now. They are all video platforms. And if you're posting text and images, you're never going to grow your engagement or audience. It's going to take 50 years. Like, seriously. You, a volunteer, somebody in your business, a beneficiary, if they're willing to do that, go on video. Doesn't even have to be a person. You could film part of today. You could be walking down the street and film everybody else. You could show your office. Okay, we'll talk about what you're going to do, but you're going to do 4 videos. Ideally live. LinkedIn doesn't do live, so you'd have to pre-record it on your phone and then upload it. Facebook and Instagram give it more, the algorithm pushes it further. Not much, but a little bit further than pre-recorded. You're going to do 4 blogs, and those blogs on your website or somewhere. If you don't have a blog function on your website, you can use LinkedIn. They've got articles, and then you can share the link from LinkedIn. They don't have to be any more than 200 words, so don't panic. Then you've just got 12 posts left. Have you got 12 images in your organization, or could you take 12 images in the next month to go with the text that I'm going to help you with? So just keep it simple. The simple ones, people are actually going to read it. The reason I'm telling you to do blogs, so if you've got a blog function on your website, it is the only way, well, it's one of the best ways to boost your SEO if you're doing a weekly blog. So everybody know what SEO is? Search engine optimization. So if you've got a website, unless you've got new content on there every week, it's doing nothing for you. People are probably not finding it, because the way Google works and most other search engines work is that they're looking for websites that link to obviously what you search for, but are also having regular new content. They're live, you know, otherwise they just look like old dated websites. So if you put one blog a week on, it's keeping it fresh, updated, and it's more likely to come up the chain in Google. So that's why we're doing it. It also means you've got then a piece of content to share as a post on social media. So you're driving people to your website, both organically and intentionally from your audiences. So what are these 12 pieces of content? I've got 20 pieces of content, so you can use these to decide what your prompt is for going live, what your prompt is for your blog post, or for any of your social media posts. And I'm just going to talk through them very, very quickly, because some of them will need explanation. Some of these things will work for your audiences, some others won't. And then you can, literally my suggestion is you can rinse and repeat and try it for 3 months, because it will take that amount of time. You could get a VA in, a virtual assistant, to do this in 3 hours at $10 an hour. I've just done this for my business. It's going to cost you $30, which is about £20-25. So you have to create the content for them, but they'll post it for you and automate it. So who you are and why you exist, we've already talked about that. The problems you're tackling, and you've probably got loads of content on this because you're probably tackling more than one thing. Why you care, why other people should care, all the things we talked about. Your vision, so that could just be your vision statement, or it could be your vision statement and you expanding on it a little bit more. Those 4 things and what you do is probably stuff you already have on your website or should already have on your website, so just copy and paste it if you want an easy life. I mean, you can tweak it if you want to go really snazzy, but like, just copy and paste. A statistic demonstrating an outcome or output. So one of the things you already know, we've had 10 people attend. So Nicola could post, had 15 amazing social entrepreneurs at today's event, and a photograph of today's event. That's that post done. Evidence of the change you create and impact. So that might be some of the stuff Nicola talked about earlier. If you're starting to demonstrate your impact, you'd share some of that. It could just be a highlight or a headline from your report. Decision post, question, what you're up to this week, who you work with, your partners, talking about them, why they're interested. This is really good if you're on LinkedIn and you're trying to get corporates. So we try and do this, probably not enough. Talking about why our corporate partners are already involved, the benefits they're seeing, because it helps other corporate partners see, oh, we're interested in that. sharing your blog, if you've got a podcast, a press release. So if you're doing press releases, just share the press release as the blog. Just put it, copy paste it, put it as the blog, and then share it out. It's just getting it out to a wider audience. It gives you some content. If you get it in the press, share that as well. An opinion post. So think about what your audience likes. And this is quite helpful in terms of that question about what are we going to be blogging about. It's okay to blog about what's important to you, but what's even better is to blog about what your audience is searching for on Google. So I do, this is relatively easy for me. So whenever I write a blog, I think, what are social entrepreneurs putting into Google? Now I know people are getting onto my website because they're searching awards and funding in social. That's nothing I teach about or help people with, but that's how people get onto my website, through my blog about that. So sometimes it's not the things that you're doing, but it's the things that you know your audience is asking. Okay, and then we've got case studies, testimonials, calls to action, and any other relevant links. So this could be something else you've read, another organisation shared that you want to share. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Kat. So many ideas to get you better at sharing what you do and the impact that you're having. And if you'd like to take her up on her content challenge, then please let us know how you get on. Tweet us at FlourishCIC. This was recorded at a recent Flourish event. We have a great programme of events coming up if you're interested in starting or you are indeed running a social venture. To find out the latest, simply visit eventbrite.com and search FlourishCIC Manchester. Speaking at the same event as Kat was Grace Dyke. She's one half of Yellow Jigsaw, a PR marketing social enterprise who specialises in working with the not-for-profit sector. You'll have heard her on our last episode, and here she is again, this time talking about strategies and practical advice for getting that coveted press exposure.
Thank you. I'm going to hammer you with tools and tips and tricks to make it really easy to use the press. As I said, my name is Grace. I am a co-director of a social enterprise called Yellow Jigsaw. We have been going for 5 years now. Just celebrated our fifth. Wow, there's actual energy after the pizza, so that's good. And we deliver PR services, campaign services, outsourced marketing departments, if you like, for organisations purely in the not-for-profit sector. I met my co-director, Kirsty, whilst we were both working at Alzheimer's Society. She was managing regional press. I was managing regional campaigns. It's sort of seen as a bit of a dark art, PR, and working with the media in terms of broadcast, TV, radio, as well as print. It's not. There are a few recipes, a few formulas that I'm going to share with you that can make it easier. It is a graft. So just because you've written something doesn't mean, poof, it's going to get in and you're going to get plenty of coverage. There does need to be a bit of a strategic approach to it. But hopefully with these tips and tools, that will make your job a little bit easier. It is very competitive as well. So there is this view that print is a dying trade and no one reads the papers anymore, but that's simply not the case. There are shrinking newsrooms, but there is still a demand to print stories, be it in hard newspapers or online. So my colleague Kirsty was at one of the titles for a number of years, Stockport Express. How many emails do you think she received a day in terms of press releases? It's around 300. And that was when they had a team of 12 and a photographer. Now they have one person covering the same patch, covering the same paper, and online content as well. So they're going to be getting so many emails, so much content. It's really important that you follow these basic principles to make their job easier and make your story stand out as newsworthy. Your social impact is pure gold for generating stories that will make it into the press. So obviously I am biased. I'm going to tell you that it's a brilliant thing to get into the press, but here are a few reasons why we think that is. First of all, credibility. Now that can be a bit of a contentious subject, really, especially in the world of fake news now. Perhaps you'd think that our traditional news outlets don't hold as much respect as they used to. But a recent survey by Forbes, the business magazine, found that 50% of internet users may find out a breaking news story on social media. Who does that? They find out about a local incident on Twitter, but then they'll go onto a news site such as BBC News, MEN, to actually get the facts. So we are still used to trusting these sites when it comes to objective stories. So if you are trusted to be published on those sites, that will boost your credibility. I've added this point in about protecting your cause and protecting your idea because of the discussion that you had with Kat Somebody said, well, what if you've got an idea, you share it with somebody, and then they run away with it? If you're visible and in the press and using communications to be seen and heard, then that is a way of protecting your idea. Google rankings, again, Kat mentioned SEO. This is the same thing. She mentioned that having up-to-date content on your website will make you be seen as favourable in the eyes of Google and their algorithms. Definitely, they want to be presenting people who are searching using their search engine with relevant content, but they also want to be presenting people with websites that they believe are reputable and trusted. So one way they look at this is to see how many other websites on the internet are linking back to yours. And if a reputable website like BBC News includes a link to your website at the end of your news story, that will be seen great in terms of Google rankings, and you'll be boosted higher because you're seen as a trusted source. Obviously, it's a great way of raising awareness and increasing understanding about your cause, your project, whatever you're campaigning on. There's been a lot of talk about how we use social impact to engage funders. This session is about press and how we use social impact to get into the press, but I'm going to try and relate some of those tools and tips to how you can use those tips to convey your messages in a way that will win over funders as well. And I'm not sure how many of you have applied for funding and it asks for attached evidence, supporting evidence. Would it be great to be able to submit some lovely published press to show that you're being recognised in your sector for this? Funders are often seen as a bit of a robotic law. Computer says no, but at the end of the day, they are people reading your story. So we want to make it as engaging and exciting as possible. And they are going to be excited at the notion of funding someone that's being recognised in the press. So it all helps. Helps to influence change by spreading key messages and campaigns. It is a way of getting your ideas across. And if you're getting it in a trusted news site, then people are going to take notice and maybe share, believe in your ideas and want to hear more about you. You want to be seen as an expert in what you do. If you are being trusted to share your opinions on news sites, then that is a way of building your authority. Share an example of the chief exec of Social Enterprise UK, who responded to the news that Apple was dodging taxes a couple of years ago. So he did a counterpiece based on that with the title, "Not All Big Businesses Are Bad Apples," which is a great play on words, but it was all to push his agenda of social enterprise is the way to go. We can have socially responsible businesses. And he got loads and loads of shares purely from sending a letter into the letters pages of The Guardian online. So it's a great way of influence and change. When done well, it's cost effective. Who reads advertorials? So the paid content. So sponsored content. They should be saying when it's sponsored, when it's in partnership with a brand. And as soon as I see that, I don't know about you, but I just switch off. Because it goes back to that credibility point. We read the news because it's objective. We want facts. We want to learn about something. We do not want to be sold to. So you shouldn't be paying to get column inches, be it online or in the print. You should be sharing a newsworthy story, which in that sense, you're not paying to get in. Therefore, it's cost effective. There's still the graft to put in, which is the cost of your time, but I hope you'll agree it's worth it. So what different types of press are there that we can go for? First of all, there's the mainstream press, so that is the likes of MEM, BBC News. Then there's social enterprise related press. The likes of the School of Social Entrepreneurs and Social Enterprise UK have newsletters that are specific to our sector. So if you want to get known amongst your colleagues and your peers, make sure that you're submitting stories, and newsletters, which are run by these sorts of networks, are a lot easier to get into. Positive News and Good News Network and the Happy Newspaper is sort of a culture change where it's not just for our social enterprise world, it's for the day-to-day person that is thoroughly depressed after reading one page on BBC News or MEN. So it's about promoting ways that people are trying to solve our problems in society and talk about them in a constructive way rather than talking about the problems and the issues, which is what the press tends to do. So as social enterprises and with your social impact stories, you are in a fantastic position to sell your story to the likes of these positive news outlets. So definitely take a note of them or read up on them when Nicola shares the slides and see if you can link in and share some of your stories. Thirdly, trade press. So this is any press which is specific to a certain sector. Any sector is going to have a specific publication which will be really powerful for you to get into if you want to be known by the influencers and the important people in your sector. The best way to find the trade press is to look at people on Twitter that you're following, look at people on LinkedIn who are from your sector, see what they're sharing, and just do a Google job and see what sort of publications are coming up. Get the email alerts straight into your inbox. A lot of these trade press will do a weekly bulletin of the top stories, so you can get a little bit of an idea of the flavour they're looking for, the sort of tone, the sort of stories that they cover. Be proactive. So that's the last point. Broadcast press is TV and radio, and local radio, regional radio is a great opportunity for you to get on there and talk about what you're doing, try and influence people and gain recognition for your work. So just because you've got this amazing story, you believe that your work is incredible and it's changing lives, unfortunately, that isn't going to be enough to get into the press. There are a few aspects of a checklist that you need to follow in order to make sure that your story is newsworthy. This is where the formula comes in. There's certain aspects that you just need to tick off in order to make that journalist happy. First of all, how is it unusual? And that doesn't have to be Wigan sending a pie into space to tell the world that they're having a pie eating competition, which is a news story that they ran with. But it just needs to be something that is out of the ordinary. We don't report on just daily occurrences in the news. Is it new? Is it a different way of doing things? Is it a new outcome? This is all stuff that can be fed from this social impact reporting and measurement that you do. The most important aspect of all of this is the pub test. So this is when you take your organisation hat off and you put on the hat of the journalist and you think about what is the first thing you tell your mates down the pub about what you do, about your story. And that first thing that you tell them is usually the hook. Now, we use that test because we're so embedded in our organisations and day-to-day going on. We talk to funders, we talk to stakeholders, we talk to customers. We can talk in organisational speak. That isn't what the newspapers want. They want that really interesting hook which makes you go, oh, you never guess what. This is what makes a difference. Or this happened to Jane, who we worked with last week. We can't believe she went from this to that. And if you actually do that exercise, you don't have to go to the pub. If you want to have the excuse to go to the pub, please do so. But talk to a colleague and just be really conscious about what is the first thing that you say that comes to mind. Make it relevant. So how does your social impact link to the wider news context or the wider sector? If it's regional and you want to get sub-regional press, so Nicola shared an example before where we did a Greater Manchester-wide project. We were tasked with getting press in every single borough as well as Greater Manchester-wide press. And the way we did that is we had to tailor that project to each area. The main story stayed the same, the project stayed the same, but the quotes, the photos were from local people. So the press is about knowing what's relevant to us. As I've just said, it's got to be about people. We don't want to hear about core services frameworks. I don't want to hear about your organisation. I want to hear about what you're doing to change lives in that community, whatever that community might be. It can't be promotional. It can't start off with breakthrough has inspired thousands of people to do X, Y, and Z. You have to be objective. You can't be using those sorts of descriptive words. You have to be telling the news as it is in very dull language. You can bring it to life in your quotes, but as soon as you start bigging yourself up, they're going to get in touch and say, this is a great story. Let us charge you for it because it sounds like advertorial. So we've thought about the checklist. You've got your social impact story. You understand now what principles you need to follow in order to make it newsworthy. Here's a few aspects of the content that you need to include. Firstly, decide on your hook. So hopefully you'll have done the pub test by now. You'll understand what to lead with as your story. Communicate your social impact in a tangible Joe Bloggs kind of way. And the press love this sort of thing. So you may find that for every £2 you invest, you create X amount of value. How do we make that tangible to the reader? So for the price of a coffee, we have generated this amount of impact in Manchester. Relate it to something that people can really visualise. So this is a great one if you're talking about people affected by the issue, whether it's social isolation, not getting out of the house, whatever it might be. Try and equate the population to something local. So those sorts of ways that really bring it to life, the scale of your impact, without having to talk about facts and figures too much. think about that wider story, which comes back to making it relevant, link back to the news agenda, link back to breaking news, link back to what the sector is trying to do regarding your issue to make it look like you're relevant and also that you are a point of authority on this topic. Always, always, always bring in a human side to the story. The stats win over the minds, but we always need a case study in a news story in order to win over the hearts. We want to read about people, and you'll often find with your pub test, what you end up saying first is not about stats, it's not about the organisation, it's about Jane, who, before she'd been on the website, your place's website, hadn't left the house in 3 months, and now she's going to groups 3 times a week. Wow, that's what I want to hear about. And then you can get in your impact after that. Ideally, and I mean ideally, unless you want to significantly cut your chances of getting picked up by the press, these case studies need to be non-anonymised. We've worked in this sector for many, many years at Yellow Jigsaw, and we know how difficult that is because you're working with vulnerable people. This isn't going to happen overnight. It's got to be something that you plan for. You know, when you work with people who become strong advocates or are really passionate about what you do, so start priming them, making sure you've got their story written down, making sure that they're aware that you want to be sharing the great work that you do, and would they be happy for you to share their story, and just start building that library of case studies of people that will be named. They will want to know their age as well, so sensitively make people aware of that. Because it's facts. I want to know who the person is, how old they are, where they are, so that I can relate that story to me in however I want to, whether I think it's me, my mum, my nan, whatever. I want to understand what impact that has on me. That's why we're reading the news. And they're going to want whoever's featured in the story to feature in a photo as well. So it's going to need a cracking photo. If you can share a video as well, fantastic, because I think it's 58% of people visit a news site after coming from off social media. And what have they connected with on social media? It's going to be either a photo or a video, isn't it? It wouldn't be a testimonial, because then that would be in the realms of being promotional. It would be a story. So it would be, for years I've been struggling with XYZ, and then I found this, and now, oh, I see Bob every Wednesday when I go and play bingo, and if it wasn't for Bob, I probably wouldn't be here right now. So it's a human story rather than that sort of testimonial video. And those case studies are going to be different for different stories and different angles that you're responding to. It could be a different location. You need that Bolton case study rather than a Manchester one. It could be a certain age that you need to bring to the fore, a certain issue. Your strength is in your case studies. If you have been including data in your press release, and we're talking about social impact, so I'm going to assume that you have, make sure that you are putting data from a trusted source. And there'll be a notes to editors section where you can put the full link to that. So that's the content. I mentioned the pressure that journalists are now under in terms of how many emails they get a day, how cutthroat they are then going to be. They won't even read past the first paragraph if they think that your story is going to be a mess and a big job to edit. So you could have the greatest hook in the world, but if it's a big task for them to edit, they're just going to delete it. So half of the battle is getting that story right and getting the content right. The other half is getting the structure right. And I have a handy tool to show with you. It's like going back to school. It's pretty simple. So all the important details are at the top. And in the first two paragraphs, it needs to be back to school, the who, what, where, when, why. So like I say, it's reporting on facts. We don't need a once upon a time intro. We just need what's happened, where it's happened, and who it's happened with. I'd usually start with the who so that you're being person-led. So whether that's you've started something, thousands of people have been affected by something you've done, think about the people at the top. That needs to be objective. It needs to be telling of facts. Where you can get your personality and your key messages across is in your quote. So at that point, you can be delighted, astounded, disgusted, shocked, disappointed, whatever it is that will get your message across. Save it for the quotes and make sure it is that lively and engaging. Less important detail at the bottom, and that is purely because if there is a restricted space, be it in print or online, and they've got a deadline to meet, that journalist might just cut half of the press release and not give much consideration as to what they are cutting. Like, yeah, that's fine, it's going in. And you don't want some of that critical detail to be left out. So make sure that the what and the who of your organization's name is up top in the first two paragraphs. Any background information and notes to editor, as mentioned, needs to be separated below. It's a very simple structure, but it's so easy to get wrong. And as soon as you've got it wrong, you're not going to be seen as helpful to the journalist. So content and structure is great, but now more than ever, as I mentioned with that social media research and people landing on news sites because they've seen something on social media platforms, your photo is so important. And a okay story, which may not get printed, really increases its chances of getting printed if you've got a cracking photo to go along with it. And you can take them on your smartphone. That is what journalists do. So a few tips for you. Aim for a few people in the shot. This is where quite a few charities fall down. They have a fundraising event, they get the big checkout, they get as many people crammed into the shot as possible. Kirsty used to have a wall of shame of Czech photos at the MEN because everybody uses a Czech photo and you just don't connect with it, and you don't connect with a lot of people in a photo. You are drawn into faces and eye contact, so you want 1 to 3 tops, really. Unless the amount of people in the photo is telling the story, so it is a march, it's a protest, then of course you want to show the scale of the story. Go landscape, so flip your camera over and take your photo this way, and that's purely so that they can cut it the way that they want it and crop it, and you're giving them a bit more leeway to work with your photo. Then probably not going to get in contact with you always to ask for a different photo. They're just going to move on and go to the next press release in the inbox. Try to take the photo outside unless the interior is essential to the story. It's just better lights. Include plenty of colour and include your logo if you can. And I don't mean standing in front of a banner necessarily, because that's pretty boring. But if there is some way you can have a brochure in your hand or a bag that has your branding on, it's just a nice subtle way of telling the story. And make sure your photo is staged. This is what I mean about, it's not a dark art, but there is a bit of graft involved if you really want to nail it. So an example is there was a charity in Manchester that was doing a fundraising event. That's hardly unusual, is it? But they were doing an event to raise money for railway children, and it was to break the Guinness World Record of the world's longest conga line. So to promote this event, they did this incredible shot at Piccadilly Station of a line of people with the branded T-shirts on doing a conga. That was just for the press release. They'd staged that shot to bring the story to life. They could have waited, done the event, done a check photo, and not got an inch of coverage. So it just shows, if you take that time to really think, well, how can this photo tell the story? How can I plan it? You're going to get a lot more engagement. You're going to get more engagement using those sorts of photos on social media and for your blogs as well. Avoid big empty spaces. Focus on people, especially on social media. We're drawn into that eye contact. In terms of video content, it's been brought up. A great source to look at is BBC Stories. So they do videos which are purely for social media, and they're really great at telling a story in a visual way. There's a recipe to it, so there's always subtitles because we may be watching that video at work and we don't have the sound on, and for accessible reasons. There's usually some sort of text at the beginning to introduce what this story is about. They have a storyteller, so that's someone that's been affected by your project, then they want to hear from you delivering the project, and then a few scenes which just show it in action. Now, using software such as iMovie on iPhones, it is quite easy to take all that footage, cut it down and crop it and put it into one video, and that is what journalists use themselves.
So you've got your photo, you've got your story, here is the final checklist to sell it in. So first of all, research the topic to make sure that when you send it is timely and it's linking into the wider news agenda. Be persistent. Kirsty and I are part of a PR group on Facebook, a closed group for PR professionals, and someone wrote in yesterday that they had managed to secure an MEN interview for a client after 6 emails and 23 calls, which I think is a little extreme. You don't want to be seen as too much of a pain, but it illustrates that just sending it once and sitting back and hoping for the best isn't feasible. People who are most interested in the story might not be in the office,
I've got a friend who works for the Press Association. He was doing a job for us the other day and it all had to come to a standstill because they'd lost half their department. It was getting outsourced. So just like you and I have issues in the offices, so do they. It doesn't mean that your press release is always going to reach them. So do be persistent. Send it different times of the day, different days of the week. Use the story again, send it again and just tweak it for the latest news story that you want to relate to. If you've gone to all that work, all that effort to write that press release and get that great photo, you want to make sure it's used. So keep persisting. Always send it to the news desk, which will be a general news desk email address that will be on every news site. But research the most appropriate journalist as well. This is where your Twitter lists are going to become really useful. If you can start it off saying, I read your recent story, I completely agree with your point, or saw your tweet on this, that's great. They are human beings as well. If you can flatter them and show that you've done your research, then they're going to be more inclined to read on. A big tip for you, which is really easy, but just put the press release in the body of the email. Don't mess around with Word document attachments. Make it as easy as possible to open it up and they can start reading your press release. Include notes to editors, so your contact details, mobile phone number, organisation's web address so they can check you out, and any of the data sources if you are quoting any stats. That's it. I have absolutely attacked you with tools and tips, but hopefully that's useful. Thank you very much for that.
So many great ideas from Grace. Which bits do you think you can get started on right now? Next is Flourish Talks, where Vic asks members of our network how they're communicating and measuring their social value.
My name is Beth Nunn and I am the founder and CEO of Pi Pursuing Individual Excellence.
How do you measure your social value?
So we do a number of different things. So at the beginning and end of every one of our programmes, be it a one-day programme or a year-long programme, we ask some people to fill in an outcome star. So on the outcome star, they measure 10 things. So we've adapted the outcome star to fit our needs. So there's the 5 slices that we look at for our programmes, which are communication, digital, project management, community and cultural capital. And then we also look at 5 other vital work skills. So resilience, motivation, confidence, teamwork and organisation. So they rate themselves beginning and end of that. That gives us some nice, easy stats to crunch, and schools love a bit of data. And also as well, that can help us look at overall impact. But to go alongside that as well, we do, there's then like a sort of qualitative questionnaire, so like they have to give more detailed answers and then we can match those up to their outcome stars and explain some stories. We do then also write an impact report for every school or organisation at the end of the programme. So actually then with the data, we can say, actually, this is what the data says, but actually this is the story that I've watched this young person go on.
Seems like a lot of work.
It is.
Is it worth it?
Yeah, I think so. Like, in terms of for schools, like, schools need to measure their impact. So if schools are paying for a service, they need to see what the impact is. Like, schools aren't going to rebuy in our services if they can't see what the impact is. And I do think as well, in terms of, for me, so like when Nicola's just done like our social impact report, it was quite easy. I just sort of went, here you go. And so that's, for me, wasn't a big effort. I think it's that wider social impact now that I'm starting to have a think about a bit more. Like, I can tell the story of this kid or this cohort, but now we're sort of looking at, can we have a look at actually what's that overall impact? So actually how many young people have improved this or that or the other, how many, you know, percentages of our students have done this, that and the other. And then it's the idea of actually what's the value of that, not just those young people, but then what's the value to their school, what's the value to their family, what's the value to the wider community. And also as we can sort of try and track the legacy as well, of like the alumni that we've worked with, that what's the continued impact and then the ongoing sort of value to society.
You mentioned that Nicola from Flourish had helped you with your impact report. What sort of stuff has that got in it? And would you recommend that people get involved, like a third party, to do that work?
Yeah, 100%. Like, that is so much more value. Like, that report isn't written by me. And if I'm giving that to other people, that is an independent person who's written that report. It's not me going, oh, all these young people said this great stuff about us. That's someone else who's gone out there and they've asked the questions. And actually, what's really cuddly and warm, like heartwarming, is the fact that some of the stuff that's come back from that, I didn't know that it had that impact and I hadn't thought to ask those questions. So other people will ask the questions that you didn't even think about, and some people will pick apart some of the impact that you didn't even know was happening. And I just think in terms of the time and the quality of the stuff that sort of I've got back from Nicola, is fantastic, and just in terms of it's all linked to research. So actually, again, I've now got a list of things that when I'm doing funding bids or anything like that, I've got a go-to list of things that I can go and pick out statistics from. I've also got two university students who are working with me at the moment on research projects for their dissertation. And they love that. That's like their reading list to start off with. But again, I think that's a really valuable starting point for a report. There's great sound bites in there that I can pick out and I'll be able to tweet and things like that. And there's also some really good sort of next stage. So there's some really good advice. And again, that's, do you take it more seriously if it comes from a third party? Maybe, like, you know, and that's come from, I can reflect on things all I can, but again, still a sort of a single woman band. It's quite nice to have that reflection, that sort of advice from someone of our trust, but also someone who's actually is a third party.
Brilliant. And I love that also, how that report is also giving you extra content to share about as well. Yeah. So it's all repurposing a lot of things.
Yeah, and I think as well it's so nice. Like, I think within sort of our social community in Manchester, we all sort of, it's really nice to have contracted a fellow social entrepreneur to do that as well. Mm. And I think that's something we really try to do, is actually support each other and keep the money within the economy and social enterprises in Manchester. Keep it in the family. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'm Simone Callaghan. I run a community interest company, social enterprise called The Goodness Collective, and we create connections between the local volunteering community sector and the local business community.
So how currently do you guys measure your social impact?
Social impact is massive for us because we have a lot of key sponsors, which are businesses, and they kindly sponsor the work that we do. So we need to be able to report to them that what we're doing is actually valuable and is making an impact. It's not an easy process, and I think problem that we have is that we try and count the connections that we make. So we ask people, if we introduce them, to keep in touch about what that journey looks like, what impact it's had for them, so what's come out of it, so what have been the practical things. So sometimes with community groups, it might be that a business has supported them with a resource, it might be they've offered them some mentoring, it might be they've provided some funding. So we kind of keep a tally by keeping that conversation open. But it's really hard because some of it is about a mutually beneficial relationship. So sometimes what the businesses are surprised about is actually that the voluntary community sector can do things for them. So things like, we've introduced a social enterprise that is now in the supply chain of a major construction company. So again, we're counting it backwards. So it's also about, we've created a funding stream for a social enterprise. So it's certainly not easy. It can't really be done on lots of questionnaires. I think it is just about us being as involved in the relationship and relying on the people that we've introduced to let us know what's come of it. And most of them are very good because they're very grateful, but stuff gets missed. And also there's that thing about not overclaiming. If you've introduced someone 12 months ago and they're still doing things for each other, it's like, well, when do you stop claiming that as your social value? Because essentially the relationship wouldn't be there without you, so the giving is still happening, but we don't like to overclaim. I don't think it would be fair for me to keep saying this is just as a result of me introducing.
Do you know what? I don't think you should be as bothered about it. I think you should be.
Well, maybe.
In terms of that, collecting the stories and the journeys, do you have like a big database where you note down every 6 months, you give them a tinkle, or is it more ad hoc than that? Have you got a system?
It's more ad hoc, but I think as we're growing, and we're not even a year old yet. So yeah, we do need to get our practices in place for measuring more impact, because the impact is growing.
My name is Mike Ravel. I'm from Countercoin Community Club Limited, and I work at Stoke-on-Trent and North Staffordshire.
How do you measure social value?
It's an interesting question. I don't actually measure social value, to be honest with you. I work with people who do. Flourish Together, CIC, do our social value stuff.
Ah. So when did you realise that it was important to get someone else to do it for you?
Yeah, it's just too time-consuming and laborious to capture and report all the, you know, impact that occurs. So we tend to work with other people who are good at that sort of thing.
Hi, I'm Kim Fole. I'm run a little agency called Geeks for Social Change. We try and develop things that are kind of community development and research and technology, or some combination of, to try and make where we live a better place.
So how do you measure social value?
I don't really know, which is why I'm here today. For me, the idea of social value, it's like this slightly icky term that's obviously you're kind of trying to translate economic value into social value, and I find it a bit uncomfortable. You know, as someone who's mostly been a community activist, I'm really just used to getting on with it and doing the stuff people say they want and helping people kind of achieve and overcome stuff together. But then what I'm realizing is this has been probably like the biggest barrier we've had to successful funding applications, to even like sales, which I don't think we'd really taken seriously. Because, you know, I think when you do this kind of thing, you're constantly getting this funding mindset where it's like, oh, someone should fund this good work we're doing. But actually, yeah, in the social value model, we're basically providing things that people would invest in. That's kind of where I'm thinking right now, but it's still very fresh.
Are you coming around to the idea?
Oh, yeah. It's like I say, I'm not against the idea. When I say it's icky, I just kind of mean because neoliberalism's icky. And this is like the representation of doing good that kind of neoliberalism's come up with. But we live in that economy. We can't get away from it. So like, yeah, it's not that, you know, I'm not against it.
No,
it just is what it is, you know?
It's like a bit of a, is it something you're not really not thought about before? And just, I understand what you're saying. You've just gone with the good fight and doing what you're doing. Is it nice discovering the impact that you're making, though?
I think so. It's kind of finding the right words to use. So, you know, we know in our pilot area, we've had this massive, you know, it's been a massive impact that we know through the work we've been doing hand to hand. And obviously, we've basically been giving away what other people are social value for free. So far, these companies are making money off it in their social value reports. And so we've basically been giving that away for free. So like, you know, we should be getting credit for this value we're creating. So it's been this weird position. So through the field work in the Manchester Age Friendly Neighbourhoods programme, they discovered this perception there's nothing to do. You know, this was based on sort of 6,000 interviews across a range of areas. So, and this seems to be a huge barrier to overcoming social isolation and loneliness, because if you don't know what's on, how are you going to find something to go to near you? And especially focusing on older people near you means, you know, say 4 to 6 streets away very often. And it's just stuff that just isn't published online at all. So the methodology we were working on was like, ah, now we've been told this is important. We're looking at number of groups publishing their own information, the number of groups discoverable, the number of events published a week, the number of people who are comfortable doing this training. But they're like outcomes. And actually what we've not done is then find a way of connecting those outcomes to the actual value improvement for the neighborhoods. So we've just been in this really weird situation where we've got, say, we keep having funders ask us questions like, oh, so can you just show someone who goes out more or that activities go up in the area? And effectively what they're asking us to do is monitor every single venue before, during and after, which was obviously an enormous research intervention. And I think, so as a result, we've just been going, can't do it. But I think what I'm starting to realize is maybe there's ways of making that argument that aren't doing that. But it just seems mad that we're having to make the case that if you want more people to go to group, they have to know about the group. It's slightly mind-boggling.
Yeah.
I'm starting to get the feeling that actually social enterprises are many, many times harder than a traditional business model. Because in a traditional business, all you've got to do is measure the money you make. And it's kind of a bit more straightforward. And actually, what a lot of the people in that room are doing is it's like, well, we've got this thing that we know is good, but now we're having to jump through all these hoops to justify something that just seems quite self-evidently good we shouldn't have to justify. Mm. I've been sort of underestimating the challenge that we have kind of, you know, set myself.
Yeah.
You know, there's someone just talking about dividing up your time, and like, I barely ever tweet. I just don't really see the point. And I think that's because I've not had the mindset of why I'd bother. And I think, yeah, that grid that was just shown about, here's 20 pieces of content you can do in a month, you know, maybe that is a really good use of it, one of day of my time every month. I don't know, but I've never sat down and strategically thought out, you know, there's this many days, what are we trying to achieve in the time? Who are we trying to reach? Like,
do you think you will now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. That's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Kim, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Thanks. So my name's Andrew Connell, and I'm here today with my three hats on, really. One is looking after a local charity, which is Records, a talking newspaper for visually impaired people throughout the city of Salford. Another is for a local church within a community, which has been well established. And another is as a member pioneer for the co-op, seeking to link various groups and organisations together to improve things for their local community.
So with all those organisations that you work for, do you measure your impact throughout all those?
As far as I'm aware and can ascertain at the moment, no, which is partly the reason why I'm here, so that we can look for the talking newspaper and certainly the church to try to develop a way to see what impact we are having on the local community, because I wouldn't like either to suddenly disappear and everybody say, oh, what a great organisation they're doing, and or what great work they're doing, and suddenly it's gone because we weren't measuring the social impact or weren't aware of how we could have adapted to improve our services or improve things for the local community to make ourselves more sustainable.
Do you know, it's shocking. It is shocking, actually, that people aren't measuring their impact. Is there a reason why you've not done it? Is it just because you're not at the time, or you didn't know how to do it, or...?
Well, again, my own thoughts on this are, and because it's purely my perspective, is people within these organisations, and including myself here, just aren't aware of this. Obviously, if you're in the business environment or you're in the working environment, of course, this is very much part of your day-to-day, on becoming more so of your day-to-day working practices. But of course, a lot of people in working within these charitable organisations are retired because they've got the time, and it's not part of their working day, and it's not something they have to do, so they carry on doing what they do to provide the service, yeah, as opposed to then start measuring the social impact.
Yeah.
But of course, because I'm here today, you can rest assured when I go back and feed back to these organisations that they will start having to look at this.
Thanks, Vic. We'll have more Flourish Talks in our next episode, which is out on the 1st of April. And that's it for this month's Supporting Women in Social Enterprise podcast. If you're loving what you're hearing and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please do leave us a review. Or if you're listening elsewhere, do share your thoughts and ideas on social media and tag us in at FlourishCIC. There's some really helpful advice in this podcast and we want lots of people to benefit, so please do help us spread the love.
Now, there's lots of ways for you to get involved with what we do here at Flourish. To date, we've supported over 750 women, so why not connect with us via our website, flourishtogether.org.uk. Another way to connect is coming to one of our events. One of those events is for this year's International Women's Day. We're running it on the 9th of March, and it's called Reinventing the Manual. We think it's about time more men join the conversation around equality, and we're going to demonstrate male panels don't have to be pale, male and stale. Quite the opposite. For more info and tickets, look us up at Flourish CIC Manchester on Eventbrite.
The next episode is out on the 1st of April and it's all about employment, so we look forward to seeing you then. Supporting Women in Social Enterprise is a Mike Media production and is produced and edited by Vic Elizabeth Turnbull.